Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is Monday, June 1st, 2020, and I am your host, Scott Pianowski. Before we get to my friend and our co-host today, Fred Zinke, you know, one of my favorites and a really dear friend, I just want to take a second to acknowledge what's going on in the world right now. Everybody in the world has been dealing with a very scary pandemic, which just affects us daily. You go to sleep with it. You wake up with it. You're not sure where things are headed. And I'm not a scientist or a doctor, so I'd be foolish to try to give you any intelligence you don't have already on that. We're all trying to struggle with that. And now, in the last couple of weeks, we've had some social problems that have been prevalent in the world and in America for a while that have gotten intensified. And there's some really scary and ugly things going on right now. And I know a lot of people see things one way, and a lot of people may not agree with that. I'm not here to take a stance other than I want to be a human being. I want to be mindful of what's going on. I want to try to be a good listener and just a thoughtful person who treats other people with respect. And that's what this podcast is about. That's what my work tries to be about. And I know I'll have a respectful talk with Fred. I just felt like I had to acknowledge that I'm here to talk about baseball, and we will, but we have to acknowledge that the world's in a very strange place right now. And to anybody who's hurting with what's going on, I understand that. And I hope I can understand it better as we go on and we can try to come up with some proactive solutions for what's ailing the country right now. And I have great respect for what people are going through. And I just want to acknowledge that and be respectful to that. With that said, I'm going to welcome my friend Fred. And Fred Zinke, how are you today?
I'm good. Like you, Scott, I'm, you know, pretty, I'd say, emotionally impacted by everything going on right now. You know, I'm Canadian, but still everything going on in America and in the world in general right now is emotional stuff. You know, trying to digest all the information, you know, take everything in, trying to have, you know, not avoid what's going on because it's important and it's real. But then, you know, not obsess over it maybe too much either. Although I think it's a really important, I think everything going on right now is just so incredibly important.
Yeah. You hit a great point about not obsessing with it. Of course you have to gather information with what's going on and you want to be aware of situations and you want to understand people's viewpoints and show empathy to that. But if I go too far and get to a point where I'm dwelling on it 24/7, I'm not sure if that's just the best emotional state for me to be. So I'm trying to find that balance where I'm an informed citizen of the world without going so deep into the hole that I feel like I lose my balance. And so I think you said that right. And, you know, I know I've known you well enough and we've been friends long enough that I know this is a very decent heart in Fred Zinke. And, you know, if I could be that type of person most of the time, I think I'd be doing all right. So, you know, hopefully we'll try to figure this out together as we move forward and come to a better day for America and North America. And with that said, I will very awkwardly transition to baseball. And, you know, things aren't really all that much lighter in baseball right now either. We don't know if it's going to be season. There's been some proposals back and forth. I'll just, you know, ask you for your general feel. Do you feel like we're going to have a Major League Baseball season this year? And what are your plans? Have you been studying? Have you been grinding news? Are you just going to wait until maybe we have more certainty? Just give me a sense of where you're at with baseball right now.
Yeah, I think we will have a season. I just think there's too much to lose to not have a season. You know, I think what a lot of people have pointed out, I've seen on social media who've been in this game for a while, you know, covering it, have said, you know, try to remember all of these negotiations start in a contentious place. It always starts with one side is completely appalled by the other's offer and walks away. And then in the end, almost always, they come to an agreement on time. You know, I know this is a huge week for baseball. And that if we're still sitting here with two sides far apart at this point next week, we're in a lot of trouble. But I do think they're going to figure it out just because I think it hurts everyone from the owners on down so much if they don't figure it out. And I know the NBA and the NHL compared to baseball are apples and oranges. They have a revenue sharing system, Major League Baseball, you know, between the union and the players, Major League Baseball doesn't. basketball and hockey players have already been paid most of their salaries for the season and are really just looking to get those final paychecks. Baseball hasn't started. It is apples and oranges. That being said, I just don't think baseball can allow, you know, the NHL and the NBA to have playoffs this summer and fall, and baseball to not happen at all. So I think I really do think I've seen some people just emphatically say like there will be no season. I think there's going to be a season. I don't know if it starts on the 4th of July or mid-July or something, but I think there's going to be a season. As far as my own fantasy rankings, I've kind of stepped away from the minutia style rankings. You know, those were prepped. I'll come back to them once we get a final agreement. And instead, I've kind of used the time to look at some big picture ideas and do some articles on, you know, do some extra research that I maybe normally wouldn't have time to do.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. When it comes back to grinding player rosters and roles and injuries and stuff like that, you know, if we can get some sort of stability on the season, I'll gladly go back to that. And obviously, there'd be a lot of news generated as they reconvene for what would pass as spring training. That's where you're going to get a lot of news. Mm-hmm. You're going to actually play games, and we'll get more talk about how the players are projected, how they fit into their rosters and whatnot. So answer me this. You talk about big picture. A question I've been asked on this, on different shows, on different radio shows, different podcasts that I guest on. And I know I've asked this question before. I'm not sure there's a great answer to this. And so if you want to answer this very succinctly, you can. And then if you have insight, please pass it along. A lot of people ask, okay, well, say there is a season, an 80-game season, 100-game season, 110 games, 70 games, whatever it is, obviously a truncated season. In general, how would that affect player values, strategies? Do you have a takeaway, a thrust of, okay, you know, normally I would do ABC strategy, but this isn't necessarily going to apply in this highly unusual seasonal environment? Is there a good answer to how do we adjust to a truncated season for fantasy purposes?
Yeah, I think there are going to be a bunch of factors. I mean, it's going to be wild. I think that's the first thing. I mean, if you take any season that we've played, you know, we've played fantasy in, and just, for example, stop the stats at the All-Star break and then go back and look at those stats. And then what happens after the All-Star break, like we're basically going to play a season that would run maybe roughly the length of up to the All-Star break. So it's going to be wild. It's going to be wild from accounting stats perspective. And from a ratio stats perspective, I do feel like the ratio stats may fluctuate and be a little more wild than the counting stats will. So I might steer in more to the safety of the counting stats, the players who produce those, rather than steer towards the ratios. I think the pitching side of things is going to be absolutely wild with how teams choose to manage a pitching staff in a shortened season. But a shortened season where every game means more, maybe roughly double of what it means in a regular major league season as far as on your chances to make the postseason, and a season with more postseason teams. I think that's going to affect decision-making too. I think managers are going to have to put the pedal down a little sooner than they normally would. We always say April wins matter as much as September wins, but baseball doesn't really treat them that way. You know, there is that feeling out period often earlier in the year. So, you know, there's going to be so many little tweaks to player values, I think. And I'm going to, once I really see a layout for the season, I'm going to have to think about how I would alter my draft strategy. I am thinking about steering a little more towards hitters early than I'm normally pretty strong proponent of taking pitchers early. You and I have talked about how the value of a pitcher, if you hit, is massive. And I think that's still going to be true. Short starts at the beginning of the season. You know, I'm just not sure if I can, how well I'm going to be able to hit on those pitchers.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if you're just not going to have enough of the season where you feel confident. Pitchers, you know, a starting pitcher in a full season is going to make what, 30 starts or something like that. You cut mm-hmm. that in half. Is that going to be enough time to smooth out variance? And maybe you're just going to, maybe it's just going to be safer to invest in hitting. You know, I find it ironic that I've long felt that the baseball season, the NBA season, the NHL season would all benefit from being a little bit shorter. And now we're probably going to get that for the wrong reasons, of course. You know, nobody wants to be dealing with the health situation of the world. But I think it would be fun to have, you know, when there's been, like people have said, okay, if this is a half baseball season, is it really a champion? Is there going to be an asterisk? And, you know, I think there's been partial NBA seasons and partial MLB seasons. And I don't think anybody's ever viewed those champions any different, or not to any level that I've considered. I think it just make the games will be worth more. There'll be more immediacy and more gravity to the early games because it's going to get late really early. And it's also going to mean that there's going to be a longer period. It's going to take a longer time to sort out who's really contending in a fantasy league and who isn't. And maybe we'll have some wild races where we get the last month of the season. I was going to say September, but who knows? That could be October, November, depending on what goes down. You know, maybe 7-8 teams could still win a fantasy league because there hasn't been enough time for people to really separate. And we also, and again, I'm not sure how this is going to change things. There's so much we don't know yet. But it's very possible that this fantasy baseball season may be played while other sports are more active or more in our mind and in our space than they normally are. And that's going to create some interesting challenges too. I always think one of the big challenges for a fantasy baseball owner, if you have daily transactions and your league bleeds into September and there you are with your daily transactions, if you're an NFL fan, the NFL just dominates a Sunday. And I have to make all these reminders on my phone and on my computer to make sure I go and do the maintenance required with my team because I have a lot of work responsibilities and NFL responsibilities on a Sunday, but I don't want to leave my team abandoned. And I think we might have a season where if all the sports come back, we might have situations where there are more sports playing at the same time, competing at the same time. Some of the golf majors are hoping to be played in the fall and maybe the Ryder Cup might be rescheduled. I just think that's going to be – it's really going to require just – back to basics as far as being organized and having a streamlined process. I think that's really going to go a long way towards being successful if we have a fantasy baseball season.
Yeah, I think something you said, you know, a minute ago there that I think that assuming the season happens, I think this fantasy season, the 2020 fantasy season, is going to be tremendously fun. I think the shorter schedule is going to make it more enjoyable. I agree with you on the length of sports seasons. I've long thought that you know we could have just as much fun in a 60 game NBA and NHL season, and baseball could be 120 or something like that. And I think it's going to be tremendously fun for those who do stick around and play fantasy baseball even when it starts late this summer. And I agree with you. I think owners will need to understand that, you know, their own commitment level to their fantasy baseball team has to be part of the draft strategy. Like, are you going to grind? Are you going to be the guy who grinds if a third or maybe even a half of your fantasy baseball season is during football? And maybe you play some playoff NBA or some playoff NHL fantasy. So, you know, are you going to be able to grind on? Some guys are going to grind the stats out of their fantasy baseball team. Some guys are going to put a few minutes into their waivers on Sunday, frab bidding, for example, you know, because they're so busy with the other sports. So I think you have to know thyself, know who you are as an owner. But I think this season could be tremendously fun. And like you said, we could have seasons this year where in the last couple of weeks, the standings are moving by 4 and 5 points a day. Because you see that often in June and July in a fantasy season. By September, you usually just see the 1 and 2 point moves in a day. And I could see it being like, I could see this, like I said, being tremendously exciting for those of us who really regroup and put the work in.
Very well said. And I look forward to having more discussions on this topic when hopefully we have a season that's in place and written out and sketched out. And then hopefully they can start and complete it. I mean, again, a lot of unanswerable questions right now with where sports are and where baseball is in 2020. The final thing we're going to talk about today, and I want to tell you heads up that we're not going to do a draft today. That will return on the next episode. But today we're just going to talk about the things we talk about, and that will be the end of the program. Fred and I have been recently participating in retro fantasy baseball drafting, which is I'm not sure if Todd Zola or Ron Chandler, which one of them came up with this idea. Maybe they collaboratively came up with it. I think they did both have input on this. And the idea is you get a bunch of people together. You get together on a spreadsheet that Todd has assembled, and you draft a previously played Major League Baseball season as if it were a fantasy draft. And you're going to get the stats that the players have already put on paper. Recently, we did a 1999 draft, 12 teams that you won. And then soon after, we did a 1986 draft that I actually was lucky enough to win. And it's a totally different experience. I mean, you're still drafting. We're drafting 5x5. It's a 12-team mixed league. I think a lot of that is familiar ground. But when you make a pick, when you take Pedro Martinez in 1999, you know exactly what he's going to do. The stats are on paper. And it's been a really fun exercise, certainly been a welcome diversion. And, you know, I always expect you to be a good fantasy player in any venue. As I said, you won the 99 league. You were in contention in the 86 league. I forget if you came in second or third. I think you came in second in that league. But, you know, you're one of the best fantasy players I know. Just talk about what we've been doing with these retro drafts and what some of your strategies have been.
Yeah, I think the drafts are really fun. As you said, they're a great diversion. They're great for playing around with draft strategy. I just find them a really fun trip down memory lane, too. Like, I loved doing the 99 draft. That was, like, right when I was getting really into fantasy baseball. I'd say 97, 98 were the first years that I, like, was really making my own rankings and projections and getting right into it. And then, so 99 was memorable for me that way. I picked 96 or 86 as the year. I thought that was just a really fun year. With the Mets and the way that all shook out in the World Series. And I'm being a guy who lives near Toronto. I thought the Blue Jays team, that era of Blue Jays teams was kind of fun, that mid-80s team. So anyways, I find them fun. And that's like one of my prime baseball card years when I was a little kid, 86. Like for me, I can remember, I can picture the baseball cards for some of these guys as we're drafting them. So I think that stuff's all really fun. I've treated them pretty light. You know, I do projections. I do rankings. I take the stats that Todd sends out. You know, I plug them into the formula that I would normally use to make my draft rankings. And I spend maybe a couple hours getting them ready. Nothing beyond that. And then away we go. So it's been interesting to try different draft strategies. When I won the 99 one, I inadvertently punted saves. Which is something I actually often do in regular fantasy leagues. But I didn't plan on punting saves. I started off and the best closers flew off the board. I ended up taking Keith Folk, who had great numbers, but not a lot of saves. And then I just steered into it and finished second last in saves. In this latest draft, in 86 draft, I think this is a great conversation for you and me to have, because you won it by, like, that 99 draft ended up winning by a fair amount. And I think steering away from saves and others and going into other skill sets with my pitching was good. You ended up winning this one. You punted your strikeouts and wins, basically punted having starting pitchers. I punted that. I did the same thing as you, but later. So I took one starter, Sid Fernandez, totally regretted it after the fact. I was trying to keep up in those categories, fell by about round 7 or 8, hopelessly behind. And then steered into the same path that you were on, but ended up finishing 2 points behind you. And I think part of it was drafting Sid Fernandez instead of just drafting a hitter or a great reliever in that round. So I've been punting categories, but on the fly. I go into the draft planning on not punting and then just steer into something if I find myself lagging behind. Were you planning on punting those categories like when we started?
Yeah, what I did, the first one that I did that I think Jeff Erickson won, and I can't remember what year it was, I saw him punt batting average. And I first went into this, I put the first one I did, I must have put in maybe a half hour of just doing a very quick and crude ranking list, knowing that it was going to be like the equivalent of using 1965 golf equipment and trying to win the Masters. I mean, I know there are people in these things who are modeling stuff and coming up with elaborate spreadsheets, and I wasn't going to be able to compete with that, at least for the first one. And I went into it, I wanted to be competitive and protect the integrity of the room, but I was also doing it to convene with these guys, to talk to my friends, to think back of players from previous generations and have fun, have that baseball card moment that you talked about. And I hadn't really thought too much about the strategy. I'd driven in my car a little bit and thought about it, thought about the year in question, but I hadn't really dug into second, third level stuff yet. And I saw Jeff punt batting average in that league. And I thought, man, you know, that's really, I can really see the case for that, because then you can just focus on the other four categories a player presents. It simplifies the player pool for you. And there's going to be players who you put value on. You don't care that they might hit 211, where other people aren't going to touch it because they care about their batting average. So I made a point that I was probably going to consider punting batting average in a future league. The previous one that I did, I think I did a second 1991 one that you weren't involved in. I was so disgusted with my first performance. I said, okay, I got to try some things here. I think punting is the way to go. So I got into a second 99 draft that Ron ran and Todd ran. And I think I came in third in that league, thinking that, again, with a punt strategy, the thing with punting is you can punt in a general fantasy league and you don't get the specificity and the exactness that you get in this league. If you draft, say, for example, I punted the starting pitching and I went after saves and the ratios. If you did that in a traditional fantasy league, you got to make sure your closers hit. You got to make sure the pitchers that you're accumulating risk on actually pitch well. In this format, you know what you're getting. When I drafted Dave Rigetti in the first round, I knew I was getting 46 saves, far and away the save leader in Major League Baseball, and really good ratios, and even some strikeouts. If I decided to turn base and wanted to compete in some of those other categories, at least he did get some strikeouts, that it gave me a chance to do that if I felt a U-turn was necessary. So I think punting is a lot more efficient in this retro format, because you know exactly what stats you're buying, where in a regular season, you're just betting on what you think the player's plausible range of outcomes is, but you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know who's going to get hurt. There's going to be a lot of variance to what you actually get. But I do think there's a lot of pros about punting in this format. And I think part of it was just so I could limit that. I could take some players. I did a very, very simple scoring format. I took batting average out of it. And I put linear weights on home runs, RBI, stolen bases, and runs scored. And I'm not even sure if I'm using the best numbers. I just did something that seemed back of envelope made sense. And I ranked the players, the hitters, as if batting average didn't exist. No, still having the batting average on my page, still knowing I could consider it if I decided to. And the funny thing is, so many people decided to punt batting average in the last league we did together. I actually got 4 points in batting average because three other people weren't trying to get batting average either. So I actually had to be mindful if I wanted to protect that four as opposed to go down to 3-2 or 1. I had to consider batting average, but I still felt I could draft a player who didn't have a good average if he filled other stat categories. But anyway, as far as the punting goes, because there's so much exactness in what you're buying, I felt that the punting was a good strategy, and I felt that it also made what could be initially an overwhelming player pool, it made it a little bit easier, more pliable for me to handle it.
Yeah, I think what you said about batting average raises a good point. Jeff Zimmerman mentioned this too. He was trying to punt batting average, and so were several other guys. So the hitters he had targeted, those low average guys with a lot of counting stats, he thought he could get a lot of them. In the end, he ended up fighting for them, and that made his strategy a little less effective. So it's like, it's a little bit, I think, if you lock down a certain punt before we start, you don't know what the other, like, you don't know what the other, 11 guys are planning going into it. I found there to be a lot of variety in these leagues. Like, I thought I would be able to predict exactly how the order of the players would go because we have the stats, and they haven't gone in that order at all. And it's because people are playing around with different draft strategies. So, and I think that's really cool. So in the end, there's been a lot of variability, makes the room less predictable, makes it more interesting, I think. So I wonder if the better plan is to be prepared to punt. Like you said, when you drafted Dave Rigetti, which I think you took in round two, you knew he was far and away the saves leader that year with 46, but you also knew he had plenty of strikeouts, great ratios, and I think he had 8 wins. So if it came to you in round 3 or 4 and there was a starter just staring at the face in the face, you're like, this guy, come on, he should be gone. You could take him and just you're punting wins and strikeouts plans out the window, which is kind of where I went with Sid Fernandez, and I shouldn't have, maybe, because I didn't steer into it hard enough. But I think being prepared to punt like a category or two categories has been pretty successful. So I know you kind of mentioned some of the pitfalls of doing this in a regular league, and I totally agree with you. Like, it's hard to punt categories when you're assuming your guys are going to produce in these other categories, and we can't assume that because they're going to get hurt. But has it made you even like a little more open to the idea of punting in, if you did some upcoming drafts for this season? Has it made you like a little more open to the idea of, say, punting even one category? Probably not two, but one.
The funny thing is, since I've been with Yahoo in the late 2000s, they brought me in to write a blog called Closing Time, which is, it's morphed into a review of the previous day in fantasy baseball. But the initial goal of Closing Time was to talk specifically about saves and closers and the ninth inning and all that. And I still think if you're going to punt one category, look, I'd like to be competitive in every category, but if you're going to punt one category in fantasy baseball, I think saves is always the way to go, because it's the most variable, because it's probably the easiest one to pick up mid-season if you decide to be in on it. I know a couple of years ago in Tout Wars, you hit a bullpen. It didn't go the way you wanted. Early on, you said, you know what? I'm just going to give up saves. I'm going to trade the save assets I have I think you may have had one closer. I think you traded him to me. Imagine that, Fred Zinke making a trade. And now you're freed up to not have to fab on those guys. I mean, if you want to, if you get a guy at your price, fine. Maybe you can flip that asset somewhere else. I know a couple of years ago, I won a league, an auction league that I'm in Michigan, where my bullpen went belly up early. It's a league with only 20 pickups. And I said, you know what? I'm just not going to make a go of it in saves. This league has more than the 10 standard categories. So I thought it was more viable to actually punt in that league. And it was such a relaxing summer, not chasing my tail, not going after every guy who may have warmed up the eighth inning of a game and maybe a closer in a week or two. Look, if you can hit on those guys, if you have a year where you're clicking on those guys, great. You know, last year I was big on Kirby Yates. I love drafting a closer from the B pool who could be an A closer. Yates was that guy last year. I think maybe Hector Neris could be that guy this year. I'm always, in theory, wanting to be competitive in every category, especially in a 5x5 league with 10 categories. But if there's a league, a stat, I'm going to punt. I think saves is the overwhelming number one target to do so.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I've punted saves probably in Towers 3 or 4 times. And I find it's a great strategy to put yourself in the money and in running in order to run away with your league. I think when you punt saves, but it's always put me like punting saves and then trying to like work hard managing your team otherwise has allowed me to be like in the top three in contention and then kind of see how it shakes out. I do remember the season you were talking about, and I think that's where I learned the lesson where maybe I drafted one closer and then he wasn't working out, and then I changed gears and punted midstream. And after that I kind of said, if you're gonna punt, then punt right from the auction or the draft. Don't use any resources on that stat category. You know, if you go backward, if you go like just, you know, kind of back your way into a couple guys who emerge as closers, then that's great. You know, maybe you get more than one in that category, but don't spend any draft or fab resources trying to chase saves. And saves is the easiest one for that reason. I do think that in the current fantasy landscape, I could see a strategy of punting steals. You can't with a lot of these retro drafts we do because the steals are everywhere. The steals are localized enough in the current game where you could try to just draft guys with 5 steals or less. It'll feel like a waste when you have 50 steals at the end of the year and you're still last, or 40 steals and you're still last. But there are so few base stealers out there that I think you could zero the steals category in your rankings and just punt that one. I think that one's not bad. And I think you can punt batting average. I think that's another one where you can make it a non-factor. If you happen to just back your way into finishing second or third last in batting average because someone else's team just really tanks, then that's great. It's the one of the categories where you could do that anyways. But I think those are the other two. I think now there are too many homers to punt any of the other counting stat hitting categories. And I'd never want to punt 2 categories like we do in the retro draft. I wouldn't want to do that in a real league. But I think you could make a plan to punt steals or batting average. And that's the kind of thing that I wouldn't mind trying out in a 2020 league. Like if I have a draft coming up, you know, after everything gets settled, try a league. I'll zero steals on my draft sheet, give everyone 0 steals, reprint my list, and draft that way and just see how it goes. I think this is a fun year because of the shortened season. Maybe try some things.
It's a great idea. You mentioned this already on some level, but if you punt batting average, it doesn't mean you're taking necessarily the lowest score. You may have, all you need is a couple of overachievers on your roster. You know, a guy who has a career 235 average could reasonably hit 285 if the right, and in a half season, maybe even higher, you know, with the right hit luck or you know, maybe he makes some improvements. I mean, just think of about a guy like Bryce Harper. What he's hit as low as I think 234, 240 or something like that, and I think he may have won a batting title or been in contention for a batting title hitting the 330s, 340s. There's a ton of variance with batting average, and whether it be with good players, with average players, or with the guys at the bottom of your roster, there's a range of their reasonable outcomes, and they can even go outside that. The great thing about punting stolen bases is that if you ever need the U-turn out of it, it's just not that hard to do. You find somebody in your league, they're running away with stolen bases, and maybe that won't happen as much to the extent in 2020 with half of a season about. But there's generally going to be striation where somebody has more stolen bases than they need, and it's actually behooves them to get rid of them. And maybe you can come together and deal from an excess that you have. I think you made a great point. I think you were kind of hinting around to, if you tried to punt the power categories, you'll just never catch up if you don't draft that on draft day. You're going to have a power base. Guys don't go from hitting 5 home runs to hitting 32 home runs. It's just nothing. It's not realistic to expect the fluctuations in those categories. Yeah, I know Jorge Soler last year was a great story, but point is, if you don't address power at the draft, you're not going to have it unless you like maybe dismantled a really good pitching staff to get it, and then you won't have any pitching. So I wouldn't want to punt the power categories, but I think the fluctuation of batting average and the variability makes it reasonable. I think the fact that you don't need that many things to go right to be competitive in steals, so you can always have that option to go in there and jump into it. Another thing I found interesting about these retro drafts versus a regular fantasy season, when I'm at Tout Wars, when I'm doing the Yahoo Friends and Family League, I will look at projected standings during the draft. It's available in the Yahoo Draft applet. I will do some drafts off, run some draft software at Tout Wars, and hopefully we'll be back at Tout Wars in 2021. And by the way, I want to send our condolences out to the guys at Foley's. They announced they're going to be closing down the bar in New York City. What a great place to celebrate baseball, and I really love the people over there. When I'm in a live draft, I'm looking at the projected standings. It's just an alignment check. Where do I'm not taking them by any means as gospel, because projections are just ranges. They're not mandates. They're not, you know, maybe I like a player more than the projection says. I don't actually have my own projections in the software that I use. It's just a way for me to get a sense of how do I look? How do I generally look? Am I competitive in certain categories? Now, when we're doing a retro draft, the projected standings are actually the standings. There's nothing projected about them at all. It actually shows you where you are. And every time you make a pick, the standings change, which is one reason why those leagues are so much fun, because it's like a horse race. In real time, you know exactly where you are and what you need to do. Now, I wouldn't mind in a league like Tout Wars, if I came out of a Tout Wars and thought, oh, wow, I'm the runaway home run guy, or I have more projected stolen bases or saves or whatever. If I had imbalances in my roster, but I felt like I got a lot of value, then I'd be fine. Okay, I have the whole season to figure this out, and maybe I'll make trades or I'll adjust my roster as it is. In this retro draft, it's not gonna help you at all to be 40 stolen bases ahead of everybody else or 30 home runs ahead of everybody else, because you can't fix that. You can't trade that, leverage that. That's going to be what it is. It's going to be a mistake to be way ahead of people in a category and when you could have maybe allocated those resources towards something else. So what I'm leading up to here is, I think obviously you have to pay attention to the live standings in a retro draft much more acutely than you would if you even care at all during a live draft, because the specific numbers that you're buying. But also, I think I always want to be mindful in a draft of what other people are doing and what their strategies might be and where they're coming from to an extent. I don't know how much you can constantly know that, but I'm trying to be aware of it. In a retro draft, I think it's critical. You have to look around and see, what is Eric Carabel doing? What is Fred Zinke doing? What is Jeff Zimmerman doing? What is Jeff Erickson doing? And how does their behavior affect what I need to fill, what my next few picks may be? I'm a much more, as much as you can be aware of these things. I mean, you don't want every one of your picks to take 5 minutes. That would ruin the experience. But I think in these retro drafts, the importance of being aware of where you stand in categories and what your opponents are doing, things you always want to be generally aware of, I think they're even more hyper important in this type of format.
Yeah, I think watching the standings, I did mention about a week ago that sometimes watching the standings in these retro drafts can give you a false sense of security. You know, I could be cruising along thinking, you know, oh, I'm a little bit ahead of Scott and Homer's, doing fine. Haven't really noticed that Scott still needs 5 more hitters and I only need 3, which means if I'm 5 homers up on him, I'm trailing him in homers. So, and I think I agree with you where it's interesting. There's no clock in these retro drafts, draft clock, which I think is awesome. It's so relaxing to draft without that counting down from a minute and a half or something. But it's almost like you should have like a curling style clock. There's my Canadian reference. You should have like a curling style clock. And I do in my head. In the early rounds, I make my picks pretty quick. Like at that point, we're kind of just amassing talent and getting the standings rolling. Like I don't really care what the standings say after round 5. And then in the later rounds, I take more time because you're trying to figure out, you know, can I still catch Scott in RBIs? Well, let's see here. I need 2 hitters. He needs 1. He's this many RBIs ahead of me. And then I really take my time. At the beginning, I'm mostly just amassing talent. In that 1986 draft with the running standings, one of the big things, and I talked to Jeff Erickson a bit about this last week on the RotoWire podcast, was I made this massive jump at the end where I was like just out of first and then was like 10 points ahead of everyone else when I picked Ryan Klesko in the last round. And everyone was like, whoa, holy smokes, what happened here? But as we were coming up on the last round, I knew that a lot of guys still needed a pitcher or their second catcher, whereas I needed my utility spot filled. I could pick in 1999, which was an offensively charged year, I could pick from tons of, you know, nice stat sources, whoever fit my needs for that last round. I ended up needing some homers and RBIs, grabbed Klesko, could have gone in another direction if I needed more of a base stealer or a run scorer. But I think that's a big thing too, is figuring out what you need and understanding that those running standings, they're not going to favor the guy who took the early catcher or something like that, that they're going to favor the guy who took the early outfielder. So there's so many things there to watch. I find the retro draft so much more tiring than a regular fantasy draft, because my mind is constantly trying to gauge where I'm at versus everyone else. Whereas in a regular draft, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. I'm drafting the highest ranked guys on my list. I'm building a bit of a balanced club. You know, if you grab someone I really wanted, I'm like, well, that's too bad, but he might not work out for Scott anyways. We'll see how it all goes. But this time, if someone grabs someone you wanted, you know, you're thinking, oh, well, I know the stats. I know I'm not getting those stats back. So, yeah, and you're right. You don't need to be 40 steals or something ahead of everyone. In that 86 draft, I took Ricky Henderson, 87 steals, I think, in round one, and Tim Raines, 70 steals in round two. And boom, 157 steals, and we're two picks in. And then I had to work off of that because I didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to be at or near the top in steals. I didn't want to have 400 steals at the end of the draft. So then I had to draft a bunch of Jim Rice types in a row after that.
Yeah, with that, the entire draft going on in a 3 or 4 hour window certainly adds to the immediacy of it, and is going to be a winner when everything is done. You talk about that Ryan Klesko pick and how it gave you a nice spike. I think one thing we always want to be mindful of in a fantasy draft, and this is really important in a fantasy auction, is knowing who the $1 players are, knowing what the last round picks are going to look like and how valuable they're going to be. I didn't do this before the other retro drafts I did, but I did it before 1986. I actually took some time in 1986 and analyzed the catcher pool. I just wanted to see, okay, we're going to draft 24 catchers. I don't think there's enough catching talent that anybody's going to draft a catcher as a DH or anything. So 24 of these guys are getting drafted. Who are the best 24 catchers? If I were to totally punt that position and take the worst two guys, how bad are they? If I were to totally attack that position and get the best two guys, how good are they? And I was very acutely aware of just where the catching pool. And it's funny, I there's going to be a 1978 draft coming up. And one thing I've noticed is that the middle infield, and this is all through the 80s too, the middle infield, just they don't hit the ball anywhere near. We've been spoiled now. I've said a lot in this podcast that you can do well in 2020 drafting your fantasy shortstop in any round you want to. If you want to get a superstar, an MVP candidate, we have shortstops who qualify. If you want an up-and-coming guy, you want a post-type sleeper, you want an all-star, a batting champion, there's just anything you want at shortstop at any price range is available. And back in the old days, you were just hoping that somebody wouldn't kill you, that somebody might hit maybe 5 or 10 home runs, maybe would steal a handful of bases and hit 250. I saw Gary Templeton in 1984 win a Silver Slugger Award. His OPS plus, where 100 is average, was 79. And that was actually buoyed by the fact that he was intentionally walked 23 times because he hit eighth that year. He wasn't even a good hitter. And they said he was the best offensive shortstop in the National League. I don't think he was the right pick, but that just shows you that the pool of players was so different then. And so I guess the fantasy takeaway is I'm generally not a big scarcity guy. I think you need to know, you know, for years, it used to be, okay, Mike Piazza is the best catcher. Is he a first-round pick? Or somebody stands out at a certain position. You know, one thing I was doing in my 2020 drafts is I think the first base pool isn't as deep as it normally is, and I've been a little bit more proactive at first base, but in past years, I might have said, I can get a good guy in the 5th round, the 7th round, the 11th round. I'm not worried about first base. I actually think this year, first base has become kind of surprisingly and sneakily thin, and shortstop is surprisingly deep. So maybe that's kind of how I apply it to 2020. But it's interesting how I think scarcity to me is a little bit more important when we know exactly what the stats are. And we look back at some of these retro drafts, there's no good catchers, there's no good shortstops. I think there can be a pretty good case for going after one of those guys earlier. In the case of Rigetti, because I thought he stood out as a closer. I would never take a closer with a top 20 pick. I don't care who he is. But in a retro draft, I thought it made sense.
Yeah, and the numbers do play out with the closer that it, you could take a closer in a 2020 draft for the top 20 pick, and if that closer does get 46 saves and 100 strikeouts and a handful of wins, it would actually be a viable pick. Now, I agree with you. I can't take a closer that high in a 2020 draft because the odds that I get that return are so small. But when you see it, when it does happen mathematically, it does work out to be that valuable. It's the same thing with starting pitchers. Like you and I have talked about, if you want to take Jacob deGrom, Justin Verlander in round one, well, if they hit, if they deliver on expectations, if that pick hits what you want, it will be incredibly valuable. At the end of the year, on any player rater, on any site that has a good player rater, half of the top five or six players are starting pitchers. That's just the way it is. Like, they're so valuable when they reach or exceed their expectations. And we see that. I think the two drafts we've done retro so far, a pitcher's gone first, at first and second. I think, he went first and third in the 86, first and second in the 99. And I thought he should have gone first and second in the 86. In the 86 draft. But I've also noticed, like we were talking about with the 70s and 80s, it's not just that the middle infielders are bad. I've noticed the stats, the outfielders have balance throughout the pool. The middle infielders, other than the superstars, have like absolutely no power, like single digit home run totals everywhere. The corner infielders, outside of maybe the odd stud, have no steals. So you can be sitting late in one of these drafts and think, hey, I can catch a couple guys in homers. I just need to grab a second baseman. You look at the second base list, the best guy left has five home runs, like literally five home runs. There's, now we're so spoiled. Like, there are corner infielders in the 2020 pool who can get you 25 or 30 steals, a handful of them. There are middle infielders, like you said, so many shortstops and second basemen who could get you 30 home runs. Back then, it was almost like they all fit these narrow models. Of, you know, the corner infielders had 20 to 40 home runs and five or fewer steals. The middle infielders had single digit home runs and stole some bases. And I feel like baseball's really broadened its mind. And I think that's cool. Baseball's brought, clearly at a real baseball level, they've broadened their mind and opened it up to, over time, the power hitting middle infielder, a third baseman who can run, and even a first baseman, we see some who can run. So, and I think that's awesome. But yeah, the outside of the outfield where there's some diversity, even back in the 70s and 80s, like the stats are, some guys are better than others, but the types of players are so earmarked by the position.
Before we let you go, I'm just going to put you on the spot. We haven't talked about this ahead of time, but let's just say in a perfect world, they hammer out a baseball agreement before we talk again. I put you on the clock. It's a 2020 draft. They're going to play 80 games. You have the first overall pick. Who would be your first pick if we were drafting right now for a 2020 league?
So I'm going to give you the answer and tell you something else that I've been thinking about recently. Ronald Acuna would still be my answer, but I will throw out there that I think Mookie Betts has been tremendously helped by the possible changes that we're looking at this year. His value went down a bit when he went to the Dodgers, whether a lot of people wanted to admit it or not, from a fantasy perspective, because of the pitcher batting. The DH in the National League is going to help Betts a lot. That puts him back in a situation like he had in Boston, where he doesn't have to hit after a pitcher while hitting leadoff. The Dodgers are also one of the teams best equipped to take advantage of the DH with that super deep roster. So he should be hitting not only not after the pitcher, but after like some decent players hitting eighth or ninth for the Dodgers. I think that's amazing for him. And he's heading into free agency at, let's be honest, probably totally the wrong time coming off of this abbreviated season. Like, who knows how willing owners will be to hand out big contracts. But Mookie Betts is going to be showing, is going to want to show his skill set to the full ability that he can in a shortened season, which means I don't think he will put himself in a situation where the Dodgers could say, hey, you're really valuable. Could you just steal five bases this year? We just really need you to chill out. We need you for the playoffs. I think Mookie Betts would be like, no. Even in a shortened season, I'm going to try to be a 2020 player in this shortened season and show everyone how good I am. I could see Mookie Betts pushing right up to where you can actually consider him with that kind of Trout, Yelich, Acuna combo. And I wouldn't criticize someone who took him one now. And I would have thought that was crazy.
His ADP was probably like around 7 or 8 in the earlier part of draft season. I think you make a great point about the expected universal DH. I actually think it's more impactful for the collateral impacts it has. For example, I think of the Dodgers, right? Yeah, Gavin Lux is presumably their second baseman, a very highly touted prospect. And in the springtime, I wasn't going to touch Gavin Lux because I didn't like where he slotted probably seventh or eighth, and maybe he would even have to sit once in a while against a lefty. And now that he doesn't have to hit in front of a pitcher, it cycles the lineup through more often, and maybe somebody who could have stolen his playing time once or twice a week, that person might be slotted into a DH. There's an extra offensive slot for the Dodgers to play with. I'm much more – it used to be that I didn't want to touch anybody in the National League lineup who was batting seventh or eighth, because I know they're not going to run much, and I know they're going to be burdened by that pitcher at least a couple times a game. And I feel like you have to be more open-minded to that. And you make a great point. You know, it really helps somebody like a Mookie Betts who's going to bat leadoff for this – a deep Dodgers lineup anyway – but now he gets more buoyancy at the bottom of that lineup. It almost feels like everybody has an American League style lineup now if you get those DHs in play. And as you said, the Dodgers specifically, because of the depth on that roster, they're not just going to put an extra guy in there. They're going to put probably a pretty good hitter. And baseball's also adding a roster spot. So I think the Dodgers are in really good shape to take advantage of that. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to put a wrap on this one. I asked you for your number one pick. You said Acuna. If I told you you had to take a pitcher in the first round, or I told you, hey, I want to draft a pitcher in the first round, who's got the Fred Zinke seal of approval right now? Who is your number one overall rated pitcher?
Yeah, so I think I'm going to steer back into Justin Verlander now. I think the DH coming in the National League, that's going to cause me to drop Jacob DeGrom, who was my number one pitcher, just a little bit. I get it. DeGrom's awesome. You know, I get it. He'll still be awesome. But you know, like that is the counterbalance to some of these hitters like Mookie Betts being more attractive, is that National League pitchers are going to deal with the DH that is harder than dealing with a pitcher. It's DeGrom's ERA and WHIP are going to be up a little bit. His strikeout rate should be down just a little bit. That's enough for me to start to swing back towards Verlander. Also, I think you and I talked a bit earlier in spring training about the Astros and fans and the fallout from all that. That's all gone. There are no fans. The Astros, for all the villains that they were, maybe that'll catch up with them in 2021, but in 2020, they're playing in empty stadiums. Justin Verlander's back to healthy. The Astros are a super team. They're still one of the two or three best rosters in Major League Baseball. I think I'm pretty comfortable taking Verlander as my number one pitcher now. I don't know if I would take a pitcher in the first round in this landscape, but I think Verlander might be my guy.
I would take Acuna right now, number one overall, but if somebody was partnering with me and wanted to take Trout, I would certainly encounter the discussion. I lean DeGrom over the rest of the pitching field, but he has to deal with that Mets defense, which is a troublesome point, and also a DH in the National League. So, again, if I had a partner who said, hey, I really want Verlander here, I would listen. I would consider Scherzer. A little bit nervous about Cole going to New York. Not that I'll think he'll be bad pitcher, but I'm not sure I want to pay the price that Cole commands. He's a first-round pick everywhere. But that's generally where I stand. This is all going to be reviewed when we actually have a season on paper, and I'll be updating my rankings, and I'm sure doing more strategy articles and podcasts to help you get through that. So let's hope we come to that day soon. I want to thank Fred Zinke for being our guest today. Fred, tell everybody how they can keep up with you.
Yeah, for sure. So you can follow me on Twitter at Fred Zinke MLB. You know, not putting out a ton of writing content right now, but I'm still doing a weekly RotoWire podcast with Jeff Erickson, and still sprinkling in a few Yahoo articles too along the way.
Okay, for Fred Zinke, for our excellent producer Raghu, keeping us on the air and sounding good, I'm Scott Pianowski. Hey, let's stick together. Let's hang in there. Let's be good to one another, and hopefully get to a better day soon. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to this podcast. Share it with your friends. Rate it, review it when you can. And if you want to reach out to me, I'm on Twitter at Scott_Pianowski. Thanks for the time. Hang in there, man. If you need somebody to talk to, you can always ping me, and we'll try to figure this out together. We will have another podcast for you next week. Until then, signing off. Take it easy.
It's no secret that our world has been interrupted. A World Interrupted is a daily podcast telling stories of coronavirus and its impact on the economy. We want to cover the issues in the macro, global economics, the stock market, and our political climate. We'll also cover the micro stories, maybe the ones you don't hear as much about in the news or the media. We hope you'll listen and be a part of the journey. So subscribe today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.